come out quietly. Okay, well, it will have to run for a couple of seconds anyway, so let's not worry about that. This isn't exactly a dress to keep a trip, so I wouldn't worry about sound quality or anything like that. This is Dr. Peter Morris from the Centre for the History of Chemistry, interviewing Willard Arthur and Donald Green from the Standard Oil Development Company. Now, Mr. Green, you mentioned in your memoirs your recollections of MIT. Now, of course, you went to MIT in a very important period when Warren Lewis was building up a tremendously important school of chemical engineers. And you also mentioned Norbert Wiener. Is there anything about these two men that you'd like to sort of mention that you haven't mentioned there? Well, what would your impression of them?
Well, Doc Lewis, of course, was a consultant for the Jersey Company for many years.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a very dynamic figure. You had him, of course, and he was a very interesting man, a very capable man,
mm-hmm.
a lot of originality.
Yeah. Did he have any influence on your career? I mean, did he sort of did he point you in any one direction while you were student?
I don't think I could say that he did.
No. What about later years, when you were working for Jersey Standard yourself, and he was a consultant?
Well, I had some contacts with him then,
mm-hmm.
and it was, but not too many. He was more involved in the petroleum end of Jersey's business than in the chemical.
He made many inventions in the petroleum field, particularly in catalytic cracking using the fluid technique.
Mm-hmm.
He and Dr. Gilliland produced some very fine ideas, and they were some great help on fluid cracking using the catalytic technique.
So what was your recollection of Dr. Lewis?
Well, he was a very dynamic man and very inspirational, I found him,
mm-hmm.
over the years. And he always had ideas.
Mm-hmm.
And he came out spontaneously, and he had tremendous enthusiasm.
Would you say that he had a material effect on the research for essay in terms of quality?
Well, I think that he had quite a lot of influence. Yeah,
yeah.
I think he did.
Yeah,
I think that Russell and Murph. Murphy were much impressed. And even before them, Mr. Howard, who was the head of Plant and Oil Development, got a lot of help from Dr. Lewis.
Mm. Of course, Howard himself was a mechanical engineer, wasn't he?
Right. And a lawyer.
Yeah. What was your recollection of him, Mr. Green, of Howard?
Mr. Howard?
Mm.
Well, I admired him. He was very far-seeing, I think.
Mm-hmm.
He recognized just about 1930,
mm-hmm.
or earlier, that this country had to get into synthetic rubber.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. The price of rubber kept going up and down, go from nickel a pound up to $1 a pound.
Mm-hmm.
And rubber is very important to the automobile industry,
which
uses gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
So that's how we got into the electric arc project, because that was the only way known to make butadiene for the genotype rubber.
Yeah. Okay, what would, to what extent did Frank Howard direct the direction in which the sound that all development companies move. I mean, what I'm trying to say is that, for example, the electric art process, was that very much a personal desire of his own to move into those fields?
Well, I think he visited the IG and was much impressed by them in the late 20s.
Yeah, well, 26,
yeah.
27. Mm-hmm.
And he was tremendously impressed by them.
Right.
And then they trotted out this synthetic rubber that they had, which wasn't very good quality at that time. Mm-hmm. Rubber.
What was your personal impression of Frank Harris? I mean, when you first met him, what, in 1930?
Yeah.
And what was your personal impression of him?
Well, as I say, I admired him a great deal. Mm-hmm. I think he was sort of a cold person.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, a little.
As far as his personal relations go. Mm-hmm. But,
so would it be true to say that Frank Howard never received the backing from Jersey Standard as a whole, that he perhaps felt his ideas entitled to? I get the impression that to some extent he was going ahead of the pack and he didn't always get the
credit. Well, I think they gave him a lot of support in dealing with the IG in the early days in 1920. Mm-hmm. 27. I was in Germany with Mr. Howard when we met with the IG and visited their plant.
Mm-hmm.
And then Mr. Teagle and other people from the from New York came over and had several meetings with the IG Farben and took up the beginning of a deal with IG because we were very impressed with their work and mm-hmm. and their technique and their equipment and the way they were going at things. So we wanted to get their help.
Right.
And also, you have to realize at the time there was a shortage of gasoline.
Mm-hmm.
And La Follette was predicting that the price of gasoline was going to go to $1 a gallon then,
mm-hmm.
and that we were in for a big shortage.
Yeah.
So there was a possibility. And we visited their synthetic oil plant, yeah, which made oil from coal,
yeah,
in Wynow.
Mm-hmm.
And we saw the possibility that this would be the way to avoid a oil shortage in the United States.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So we wanted to get their background on handling oil and coal and converting them into usable petroleum products.
Yeah, but I was thinking perhaps, no doubt true, but I was thinking perhaps of a somewhat later period, maybe about 38, 39, 40, when we were trying to persuade the government to develop synthetic rubber, but he's not always the wholehearted support of the company for that.
Well, I think he still was getting their support.
Yeah.
I think the trouble came after he ran into all the difficulties with the government on the IG connection.
Right. Mm-hmm. What would be the reaction to that public attack on his motives, I suppose, is the word? I mean, were you very surprised by the warm talk?
I think I mentioned him there that I heard him say once that he felt that the company shouldn't have agreed to that consent decree.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So he felt that, well, that was perhaps the remark that maybe to bring up the comment about whether he had full support. One thing I've never quite understood, really, but he left the Standard Oil Development Company, I think in 1945, didn't he?
I don't know just when.
Yeah, he was made a vice president of Jersey at that time, possibly that time. We can check the date if you want to know, but...
I was just interested in a way and how his career started, ended, because I've never really heard a great deal about how his career ended. It's sort of, you read about him, I suppose it's partly the fact that his book came out in 1947 and that ends in about 45, but I've never really known much about what happened to him at the end of his career.
Well, it's a very touchy subject, and I would say generally that with all the troubles that happened and the bad publicity that Exxon was getting, they got a little cool to Frank Howard.
Mm-hmm.
Now, before that, they made him a vice president so that he could, have more status and prestige when he was dealing with foreign groups. But then, after all the troubles, 47-48, then I think he ran into trouble with the people who were at the top.
Let's move on a bit, or rather I should say back a bit, because you talk about the fact that you met Edgar Murphy at Sobey, Edgar Murphy. I get the impression when you write about him that here was a person who hunted after theoretical physics, because he always seems to have been very keen on theoretical physics and knowing theoretical physics. Do you think that perhaps, given another opportunity, he might have gone into theoretical physics? Or was he happy or something like that?
Well, I don't know, I don't think so. I think he was more of an engineer, but he's an engineer type. But he used theory to help the engineering.
He seems to have been a very remarkable person. I mean,
well, he was.
He was. No doubt about it.
Yeah.
He was a real scientist.
Right. Mm-hmm. Right. But that's the one thing, is there perhaps one single thread that runs through his memoirs, which is the influence and importance and extraordinary quality of the person. Could you expand upon that at all? Was there anything else that you'd like to mention in that respect?
About Murphy?
About Murphy, yeah. Perhaps about your personal...
I worked for Murphy when I was with Allied Chemical.
Right.
I guess I mentioned him.
Mm-hmm.
And he took the job with Exeter of Jersey, connection with this IG problem business. And he offered me a job, and us Tracy and Bob Carey, two of the team. And we were in Elizabeth for a while, getting going on the gas station and designing the plants.
Mm-hmm.
And we all went to Baton Rouge.
Right, right.
And ran the plants.
Mm-hmm.
And then I guess he became head of the laboratory down there, didn't he, at one time?
Yeah. When he came up.
There was a laboratory down there that was mainly working on hydrogenation.
Right.
As a result of this material that we bought from the IG Farmer.
Okay.
And there were three hydro plants under construction when I went with the company. I guess I mentioned that
about it. Talk about it coming out more, I think, in the 50th year volume of the XMR&D, where the hydrogenation plant was clearly new for a variety of other processes, like the oxide process of the hydrogenation plant. But how did Murphy come to be connected with the Manhattan Project? Because, I mean, he wasn't, to my mind, at least, an obvious candidate to be a associate.
Well, he was an outstanding engineer, and he knew a lot of people who were connected with the Manhattan Project, like Urey, for example. He had a lot of contact with Urey and other people, like Costum and the people like that. And So it was quite natural for them to, take him up and get him to work for the Manhattan Project. Mm-hmm. And he went to a lot of their meetings and did a lot of work for them. Mm-hmm. He disappeared for a few days from work, and he worked on the theoretical aspects of the fusion process that was used to make uranium.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
He worked out the basic equations for the diffusion. And then he was interested in the centrifuge approach, and we did a lot of work on the centrifuge approach.
But
he had other people working for him on the fusion and they made hexafluoride to make the separation.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Carl Cohen, the inventor.
Yes, Carl Cohen, yeah.
Yes, it's interesting in a way, because he is clearly, in the history of chemical engineering, a key figure, yet it's perhaps indicative of a lack of respect or recognition that chemical engineers get, which is probably for your average high school student or even university student, far less well-known than, say, you.
Well, it's the same old story that the scientists get a lot more publicity than the engineers do. That's the way life is. That's the way it is.
Mm-hmm.
Well, Mercury was called a Washington, after Sputnik.
Yeah.
They called him a missile czar for a while.
Yeah, he was a missile czar.
Mm-hmm.
Did you know that?
Trying to straighten out the missile program and get our... trying to get our Sputnik going.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. It's amazing the way that they call an end for jobs quite unrelated to petroleum technology. Mm-hmm. He didn't die young, but he died at a relatively young age.
Yeah, 1962.
And what position did he hold at that point? He would have been to your best friend itself.
Well, he had, as I recall, he had been taken over to New York and was the vice president.
He was the vice president of Exxon
at
that point, in charge of the sort of scientific vice president for them.
Okay. I see, he worked while he was still particularly on the scientific side.
Oh, definitely, yeah.
Of course, I think Clifton Garvin was the first chemist to become, or chemical engineer, to become president of Exxon.
I'm not sure that's right.
Well, we've had a lot of people from the production end of the business as president.
Mm-hmm. Anyway, let's move on a bit to some more.
We had a lot of chemical engineers from MIT on the board for years.
Yes, I was thinking of those within the company, I suppose. Let me just talk briefly about the ARC project, because I'm, of course, very interested in the ARC project. And I've done quite a lot of work on the pros and cons of using the ARC project, but of course the ARC project has had a bit of an unhappy history in the sense that it got used in Germany in 1940. It worked pretty satisfactorily during the war, but after the war, although various high temperature processes were on the market, nobody, I think with the exception of one Italian company that used it briefly, no company has ever got invested heavily in the ARC process.
Well, it's finished over the Hills did.
Mm-hmm.
The Hills.
All right. Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah. Well, I've been there and I've seen it, but that, of course, is purely a result, a result of the fact that it was installed there back in 1940. And I think they themselves would agree that had they not had it, they wouldn't have informed it.
Oh, I don't know about that. Well, at that time, all they knew, the only way they knew to go to make synthetic rubber was starting with acetylene.
But
a few years later, they realized, and of course we realized, that starting from butane or butylene was a lot better.
Actually, funny enough, I'm really thinking of it more in terms of in comparison with the carbide sector. You know, and here, and whereas I'm assuming that we're talking about acetylene, and here I'm just trying to compare the arc process with the carbide process or other high temperature processes.
Well, we compared them a lot. We thought the arc process was better.
I think one of the big problems of the arc process, well, as I understood it, there were three basic problems with the arc process. The first thing is that you get a lot of carbon black deposited in the...
Not very much.
But then,
just enough to cause a little trouble if you go right into the compressors afterwards without pressing out the garden flag. But that was not a real major problem.
And I think that's good.
We had this plant of bad news.
But that's basically why I'm sort of bringing this up. The second problem, what I heard about from the German end, was the fact that the process does tend to produce a certain amount of vinyl acetylene and di-vinyl acetylene.
Diacetylene.
Which are explosive and therefore
explosive.
Can cause problems at the refining end.
Well, it didn't give us any great problems. What we did, in the Baton Rouge plant, we washed the R gas with oil and took out those heavy compounds. And then we used the natural gas we treated with the arc to strip out those materials. So we didn't really have any problems.
We didn't have any problems with that. And the last problem is it's not really so much a problem as much as a balance. But although the process itself probably uses only about two-thirds as much electricity as the carbide process per ton of acetylene, you lose a lot of that advantage in the refining phase. I mean, at least when you get carbide acetylene, you can use it directly, whereas with the arc acetylene, a refining stage, a purification stage, is necessary. Is that a fair comment?
Depends on what you're going to use it for.
I see. So you were, of course, the Baton Rouge, of course. I don't think you tried to refine it very much, did you?
We washed it with oil and got out these heavy compounds and we got out the carbon black. Then we converted the dilute gas to acetaldehyde.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
But it wasn't a very good process. It was a solid catalyst.
It was
impregnated on pumice.
Pumice.
A lousy proposition. Yeah. Mm-hmm. But anyway, and then we would form cuprene.
Yeah.
We formed cuprene because there's a little copper. But outside of that, the mercury process could have been used. Was the usual process, using mercury and ferric sulfate and all that.
Yeah.
But it was kind of messy.
When I put the phone to Hall's, I think they made two comments. Firstly, they felt that the consumption of electricity was still quite good, even when one took the refining into account. But one also has to consider co-formation, co-production of things like ethylene, which they felt tended to separate the ethylene.
Who were you talking to, did you say?
The engineer that commuted the vessel hall.
Yeah, do you remember who they were?
I couldn't offhand. I put the point to the company. Well, after that, I gave the company a copy of my thesis, and it was one comment I made was about the electric violence, the violence of electrical power used by various
people. Well, this was fairly recently that you talked to me.
Oh, yes, about 3 or 4 years ago.
Oh. You wouldn't know anybody then, no. Rico Engel has retired, I understand.
Yeah.
He was the head man.
Yeah. I think one of them was called Martin, but something, you know, not a first name, a second name, but I can't now recall. Anyway, they rather reported that although the figures I told you for electricity were not inaccurate, that they didn't take any account of co-production, that you know, the co-production of ethylene, for example, wasn't important.
Of course, using ethane or propane consumes a lot less power than using methane.
This would be a good point to say, would you like to elaborate? Obviously, in your memoirs, you didn't want to be too technical. You can be as technical as you like here. Would you like to sort of just briefly check what difficulties you had in developing the art process at Baton Rouge?
Well, the first difficulty was the carbon black, which was washed out with oil. The Germans hadn't told us about that.
No.
You developed that in Baton Rouge.
That was rather a surprise to us. Well, we just put in a couple of towers and washed the stuff out.
Yeah.
And we went to reciprocating compressors, as I remember. Yeah, reciprocating compressors, which have valves in there. And the valves can just plug up the carbon black. But that wasn't too bad.
But when you say... When you say it wasn't too bad, am I going to understand that you didn't ever have to put the tubes out of action between them?
Between the compressors?
Well, I think the actual arc tubes themselves. The point being is that the German had a deliberate policy, in fact, I think still had a deliberate policy, of putting some out of service to the clean.
Well, we had a spare arc. We had two arcs. We used one at a time. But the arc itself didn't have to be cleaned.
It didn't have to be cleaned,
But the flame tube would burn out once in a while.
I may be confusing two different things here. And the tube burning out, and also, of course, the carbon black problem and the compressors and so forth. It should be possible down on the slope.
Our main problem with Baton Rouge was in the acetaldehyde plant, where this catalyst was a lousy catalyst, and it gave rather poor efficiency. And it became obvious that it wasn't satisfactory. So I was sent over to Germany to look at their plant. For converting acetylene to acetaldehyde using the mercury process.
That would be where naphthan?
Naphthan. And then when I came back, we built a pilot plant and we worked it all out. And we felt we had a process. Then, of course, the acetic acid plant was fine. We had no trouble with that at all. So we reached the point, I would say about 1939, 38, that we could have built a big plant.
But
the economics didn't look too good.
You obviously helped to solve the carbon black problem. I mean, you could even go as far as say you solved the carbon black problem. Did you give the results of that to the Germans?
Sure.
The technical exchange.
Sure, we had Germans right there.
Paul Baumann.
And his crew. We had three or four good engineers.
Did you see the article he published, a good few years ago now, about 10, maybe about 65, or maybe around that time, the article he published in the House Journal about my year in America?
I don't know. Let's see. I got a couple of things that you
I don't remember that.
It's about time to change the tape, I guess.
Is it?